From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And there's some encouraging news for those who have had COVID-19 and recovered from it. A new study shows that immunity lasts for almost a year and may last a lifetime. Immunity also improves highly with vaccinations. This research, published in the journal Nature, shows that the body likely can produce antibodies against the coronavirus after a mild case, helping to dispel a concern that immunity from contracting the virus won't last long. Let's bring in Ali Elabadi. He's a professor of pathology and immunology at the Washington University in St. Louis and was the senior author on this study. Ali, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So tell us more about what you found regarding how long immunity from the coronavirus lasts.
Sure. What we have is that what we have looked at is trying to understand when people get infected with the virus and can they actually produce the two main components of immunity. And in that we can actually, when we get infected or vaccinated, there are two lines of defense are formed. First are the antibodies. And the second line is memory. So we looked at those two lines over time, up to 1 year after infection. And those are the individuals who participated in the study came to our study and participated starting from March and April last year. So when you have an antibody, these antibodies are actually produced by specialized cells that live in our bone marrow.
Okay.
So we asked our generous participants to give us both bone marrow samples and blood samples for over a year. And we analyzed these samples and we saw that they do have those cells in their bone marrow that produce these antibodies that can last for their lifetime. And they also have the memory B cells and the memory cells that can respond rapidly if they get exposed to the virus again.
This is an amazing discovery, but to be clear, those who had the virus and recovered should still get the vaccine. Is that correct?
Absolutely. They should definitely get the vaccine. And this is, I think there is two main misconceptions that need to be clarified about the whole process of having an antibody in your system. First is, if you have an antibody in your blood against the virus, that can be detected by some of those serological assays that are commercially available now, that doesn't mean at all that you are protected. It means that you have some antibodies that resulted from your exposure before. There's a chance that those antibodies are not enough for protection, especially with all of the new variants that we are seeing that can be sufficiently different from the virus that circulated very early in the pandemic, and in that case, you are not protected. The second misconception is about that if you get a vaccine will interfere with your natural immune response. And I've heard this come many times, it was brought up to my attention, and the problem with that, it's not true because your natural immune response already took its course, and that's why the person who was infected already recovered and they made the memory B cells. Mm. And vaccination will make the best use of those memory cells. And also more good news is that people who got infected and then after 6 months got the vaccination, those individuals are making great immune response, not only to the circulating strains, but also to many of the variants that we have seen around the world. So I think getting vaccination for those who are infected before is a huge boost for their immune response.
Can you break this down for us? You know, many of us get sick with colds every year. That's another type of coronavirus, and that's because they evolve. So is lasting immunity only one half of the battle here because variants can actually get around immunity?
Well, that's a great way of putting it. Yes, exactly, because if we are talking about immunity to a virus or a bacteria that doesn't change or any pathogen doesn't change, then it's obviously great once you have an immunity that could last for a lifetime. Just think about many of our childhood vaccines that we don't need to get again because the virus itself doesn't change. But with the many of the cold viruses, influenza viruses, and now we learn about SARS viruses, that they have the capacity to actually change their major structures, and that allows them to escape some of the immunity that we formed to the previous version. So that's where we should really, unfortunately, we have to keep, it's almost like a moving target that we are trying to catch.
That was Ali El-Abedi, professor of pathology and immunology at the Washington University in St. Louis. Thank you for sharing your research with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, now a cautionary tale. The Biden administration has overturned dozens of environmental rollbacks from the Trump presidency, but a handful of key regulatory reforms to chemical safety remain on the back burner. They actually predate the Trump administration, going back to a deadly 2013 explosion in a small Texas town. The same conditions that contributed to that disaster exist today. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports.
In central Texas, there's a small town with an eternal flame. It flickers on top of a fountain, surrounded by 15 stone blocks, engraved with the names and stories of the 15 people killed on April 17, 2013, when the West Fertilizer Company caught fire and exploded here, in the city of West Texas, just outside Waco. One of those names, Jimmy Ray Matus. The plaque says he loved caring for his pets and farm animals, and spending time with his family.
But I was his only child, and it's kind of tough because I don't have my dad around.
That's Dustin Matus. His dad tried to help firefighters as the blaze grew out of control. A typical act of selflessness, says Dustin, who had to take over the family welding business.
You know, I don't get to show him, hey, look how good I'm doing now. I used to be a screw up, and look what I'm doing now. Kind of tough, but it's about the gist of it.
Federal investigators with the Chemical Safety Board determined that the explosion could have been prevented by storing ammonium nitrate, a chemical used for fertilizer, in non-combustible containers near fire sprinklers. The company kept the material in wooden bins, no sprinklers. 8 years later, those conditions persist here in Texas. And now, citing Homeland Security, the state has classified the locations of most chemical facilities.
I'm here to meet with Barry.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Texas Public Radio used existing state and federal records, as well as Google Earth, to find a storage site in the city of Fairfield at CAPS True Value Hardware and Ag Center. In the back, there's a shed with a huge pile of white, powdery material, ammonium nitrate. Barry Capps is the owner.
How much do you have on site right now?
Oh, I doubt there's much over a load, which is 25, 30 tons.
Like the facility in West that exploded, Capps stores his ammonium nitrate in a wooden container with no water sprinklers. After we spoke in December, he said he would install fire sprinklers.
We could certainly do that. But up to now, nobody's told me I need to do that.
Half a year later, Capps says he hasn't found someone to do the job just yet.
And it is disturbing to me that facilities can still use combustible wooden materials and storage bins to house ammonium nitrate. They're not required to use sprinklers in storage buildings.
Catherine Lemos is the chair of the Chemical Safety Board, the federal agency that investigates chemical disasters and issues non-binding recommendations intended to prevent future incidents. In 2016, the board asked EPA and OSHA, the federal agencies charged with protecting the environment and workers, to step up oversight of ammonium nitrate and to require water sprinklers and non-combustible storage bins. Neither agency has heeded the advice.
These two are open, and I find them of critical importance. And it keeps me awake at night.
OSHA did try to close a loophole that allowed small fertilizer companies, like the one in the city of West, to escape strict federal oversight. But Jordan Barab, the number two official at the Obama-era OSHA, says the agrochemical industry pushed back.
And eventually took us to court, and we lost the court case. The court didn't say that we couldn't make the change that we did. The court just said that we had to go through the long regulatory process in order to make that change.
There's another obstacle to new chemical safety rules. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF, spent 3 years and more than $2 million on their investigation into the fire and explosion in West Texas. In 2016, they called it arson.
And I don't have to speculate on the political implications of that kind of finding. We can look at what happened at EPA.
The EPA tried to ramp up its so-called risk management program for hazardous chemicals in response to the West explosion. But the Trump administration stalled and then rolled back the changes, and used the ATF arson finding as one of its primary justifications, saying EPA didn't take into account the alleged arson while creating the new rules. Under an executive order signed by President Biden, the EPA is again reviewing its risk management program. Very little has changed since the 2013 explosion in West Texas. 7 of the 19 recommendations issued by the Chemical Safety Board after the disaster remain incomplete.
I'm furious about it.
For Dustin Matus, whose father died trying to fight the fire, change is long overdue.
They need to make changes. They need to... Why do they not need fire sprinklers around something that is explosive? It don't make sense.
Change could take years, as OSHA and EPA wade through the lengthy rulemaking process. And as for ATF, 8 years later, their multi-million-dollar investigation remains open. The agency declined our request for an interview, or to provide any evidence that the fire was caused by arson. For Here and Now, I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh.
If you use a dating app and something goes terribly awry, say there's a sexual assault, and you report it to the app, you may think they'd have a standard response. Well, you would, in many cases, be wrong. That's the finding of a new investigation by ProPublica and Columbia Journalism Investigations. They found that many online dating companies employ untrained moderators to handle a wave of customer claims of assault, and they have to do it within minutes, like workers in a factory moving widgets down a conveyor belt. In fact, they say this huge industry has no real standards for responding to reports of offline harm or removing offenders from the platform. Now, a word of caution, we're going to go into detail about some sexual assault, but it's important because survivors have started to speak out. One stood outside the headquarters of Tinder holding the sign, "My rapist is still on Tinder after weeks of trying to get Tinder to remove him." We're going to hear in a few minutes from one of the reporters behind this story. But first, Tracy Litwin, the 30-year-old Chicago resident, filed a complaint with Bumble in 2018 after a man she met on the site and had relations with removed his condom without her consent. Now, that's not a criminal offense, but it's called stealthing by advocates who see it as a form of assault. It's unsafe. So, Tracy, a matter of trust and safety, address first people who may argue, but it's not assault. What did it mean to you?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because for me, it took a little bit of time for me to really process that what happened to me was assault. You know, I thought it was just a not great thing to do to somebody. You know, I hadn't consented to this at all, and I didn't even have a chance to say, like, wait, you know, I'm not okay with this. It was kind of that moment, you know, where you hear people, survivors, talk about being frozen, and I just kind of like sat there, laid there, and was like, oh my God, is this actually happening to me? And after a little bit of processing, I realized that it was assault. And thankfully, more people are talking about this so that other people can recognize it as assault much sooner than I did.
So with this feeling, you went to Bumble and made an initial complaint. What happened next?
Yeah, I think I had seen his profile and made a complaint, and I believe I just got a pretty benign form email in response letting me know that they were going to look into it. They appreciated me contacting them. And then I saw him again not too long later, and I had tweeted at Bumble, look, you know, this guy who assaulted me is on your dating app, and I've already tried making a complaint. And they got back to me right away. They directly messaged me, and they were able to get him banned from Bumble. But then, like, maybe a year or so later, I saw him again. So it really showed me that they're not really flagging these accounts that are being accused of assault or, you know, harassment or whatever it might be, so that when they come back up, I mean, there's really like no filter for catching these people for going back on to this app again.
Well, first, after reading this report, at least you got a response from Bumble. We're going to hear how some of these platforms are so overwhelmed with complaints about sexual assault that they're not even getting back to people, which is so frightening. But what did employees say to you about, you know, they seemed to know what was going on. They used language about what this user was doing to explain why he kept popping back up.
Yeah, I think they said that he had created a new email address or found another way to get around how they usually block people. But, you know, it's funny because I've had friends who got blocked for seemingly no reason on other dating apps. And so they can't use these apps at all. And then there's somebody who, you know, someone directly came out and said, you know, this person assaulted me or this person harassed me. And these are people who keep popping up on these apps over and over again.
By the way, you didn't go to police. As you said, this isn't, it's not criminal. But so the other thing is that you had to handle this yourself. What was that like being the one, you know, the burden on you?
I think because of the gray nature of my assault, not that like one is, you know, more serious than the other, I think, you know, I felt like capable of being able to handle it. But I, you know, there's so many people who try to go to the police or try to go to an app like Bumble, and they're just completely shut down. And it's really heartbreaking to know that we just don't offer adequate support. If you're going to offer a service like a dating app, then you should have trained people in place. And it was really surprising to me that, you know, I was being connected with somebody who really had no background in how to help me.
So I'm wondering if that's a burden, too, that you know that there's someone out there doing this and maybe doing it to other women.
Yeah, that was what was most important to me, was making sure that this didn't happen again. You know, it wasn't a sense of like justice for me, because, you know, I just wanted to make sure that other people in my community were safe from this person.
Tracy Litwin on her experience with the dating app Bumble. Tracy, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Elizabeth Naismith Pichani is a reporter for Columbia Journalism Investigations. Elizabeth, you also heard from women who were violently raped by dating site dates, but were you hearing from women who, like Tracy, were very uncomfortable and felt violated by dates?
Yes, definitely. We put out a crowdsourcing survey to hear from as many women as possible, but we were pretty particular in our request for sexual assault-related instances. So there were a few cases of harassment or perhaps uncomfortability, but I think most of them were rooted in sexual assault. And I think Tracy's anecdote in particular is still considered by experts a form of assault, even though it's not criminal, because it was without her consent. And especially with things like sexually transmitted diseases, and it's still a form of withdrawing from someone's consent.
And it's unhealthy and it's unsafe. And what about her experience that Bumble did respond, which is better than some of the other apps, and then even a year later, this fellow pops back up? How common is that, that an app tries to do something and get someone off the platform, but they can't?
Yeah, we were seeing that from several women and users saying that they saw their alleged perpetrator back online, and sometimes on another dating app as well.
Well, and explain what the system is like. These moderators who at Hinge, for instance, they are processing up to 60 complaints an hour. That's a minute a complaint. I mean, talk about how many they're getting, who these moderators are, they're not trained, and the pressure they're under.
We were seeing this common thread throughout the industry that a lot of platforms have these quotas where moderators have to meet a certain amount within an hour. Those moderators with that 60 an hour aren't actually responding to the victim, but they will be flagging the report, going through the information to try and decide whether to block him or not, and pulling relevant details like birthday, username, name. And then at other places like OkCupid, we saw, including responding to the users, they had an average of about 4 minutes, which, you know, then if you don't hit that mark, you're going to be pushed for the rest of the day. And like you said, feel enormous pressure is what we were hearing constantly from these employees.
Yeah, you spoke with them and they felt that there was no corporate guidance, no, you know, across the board policies that they could follow. And they're not, you know, investigators. What do you say to people who say, hey, wait a minute, I don't think people should just be allowed to call up a social media site and say, you should ban this person without some criminal charge? And I can hear someone saying, you might just have a disgruntled ex-girlfriend who calls some, you know, unprofessional moderator and tells them to get somebody off the platform.
My response to that would be looking at what the companies are saying publicly, and they have a lot of public promises about banning on first accusation. So that's a standard they're setting, and whether they're following through with it is another question. But I'm referencing in particular Match Group, who is really the titan of the industry and the giant player here because they own most of the most popular dating apps like Tinder, Hinge, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish. They're a $2 billion company. I mean, other studies have also found it's quite uncommon for sexual assault allegations to be false, but that's kind of another story.
I guess I'm saying these companies have set themselves up for lawsuits on behalf of people who've tried to tell them to take something down. It doesn't get taken down, and maybe somebody offends again. On behalf of people who get falsely accused, even though that's rare, it sounds like a pretty rickety system.
They really actually haven't been found liable. It's quite different as an internet company than a brick and mortar where there's, if someone slips on aisle 5 and there was a notice of it, a small business might be held liable. Actually, these internet platforms have been found to not be liable when there's been an instance from an interaction they had facilitated. And even in cases where the company had been warned and harm occurred again. And a lot of that falls under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act.
What it does is it deflects lawsuits claiming negligence for incidents involving users harmed by other users.
Its original intention, a really great example I think of, is a Yelp review. Like if someone complains about a restaurant, Yelp isn't liable for that user's complaint of the restaurant. But now it's been extended to these instances and things like offline harm and algorithms and how the platform is run from the inside.
That's investigative reporter Elizabeth Naismith Pichani. She's with Columbia Journalism Investigations. They linked up with ProPublica to do this investigation of dating app industry. We'll link you to their findings at hereandnow.org. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
The late actor Chadwick Boseman did not win the Academy Award for his role in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, as many thought he should. But another honor is being bestowed that may be more lasting. His alma mater, Howard University, announced this week it will name the newly reestablished College of Fine Arts after Boseman, who graduated in 2000 with a bachelor's degree in directing and died last year after a private battle with colon cancer. He'd starred in blockbuster films like The Black Panther.
I am not ready to be without you. A man who has not prepared his children for his own death has failed as a father. Have I ever failed you? Never. Tell me how to best protect Wakanda. I want to be a great king, Baba. Just like you. You're going to struggle.
So you'll need to surround yourself with people you trust.
You're a good man.
And even as Chadwick was achieving fame and getting other honors, he continued to work with Howard to strengthen its College of Fine Arts. In 2018, he was invited to speak at Howard's 150th commencement and touched on his early acting career and his time protesting Howard's efforts to merge various academic programs, which was controversial. He applauded the students who had recently completed a 9-day protest to get university officials to amend school policies related to housing and campus policing. And he made a powerful case for purpose, encouraging graduates to find it rather than a job or a career.
Graduating class, hear me well on this day. When you have reached the hilltop and you are deciding on next jobs, next steps, careers, further education, you would rather find purpose than a job or a career. Purpose crosses disciplines. Purpose is an essential element of you. It is the reason you are on the planet at this particular time in history. Your very existence is wrapped up in the things you are here to fulfill. Whatever you choose for a career path, remember the struggles along the way are only meant to shape you for your purpose.
Some people have memorized that. Chadwick Boseman also talked about the challenges of Hollywood and how he voiced his power.
So you went to Howard University, huh? The exec holding my resume interrupted, peeking over the pages. Yes, I said proudly. He slid my resume back in his desk and said, "Thank you for your concerns. We'll be watching you." I left the office. I shot the episode I had come in to shoot on that day, probably the best one I did out of the three, because I got what was bothering me off my chest. I was let go from that job on the next day. A phone call from my agent. They decided to go another way. The questions that I asked set the producers on guard and perhaps paved the way for a less stereotypical portrayal for the black actor that stepped into the role after me. As the scripture says, I planted the seed and Apollos watered it. But God kept growing.
Chadwick Boseman died last year at 43.
Over the last few days, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has made his way through the Middle East, we've been hearing a lot about the Egyptian president's role in brokering a cease deal between Israel and Hamas. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's actions have earned him the gratitude of President Biden. Until now, the two hadn't forged much of a relationship. Well, for more on what this means, let's bring in Sudarsan Raghavan. He's the Washington Post's Cairo bureau chief and joins us now on Skype. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Sudarsan, let's start with the beginning. What was Egypt's role in this ceasefire?
Egypt played a very significant role in achieving this current ceasefire. What they did was they sent mediators to both sides, both towards the Palestinian militant group Hamas as well as to the Israeli side. You know, the Egyptians for years have had incredibly close relationships with both the Israelis and Hamas.
Well, what has this meant for Sisi's relationship with President Biden? We know that it took the president months to reach out when he first came into office.
Well, it has meant everything to President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Under President Donald Trump, as everyone knows, Donald Trump called him his favorite dictator. And in fact, Sisi could absolutely do no wrong during the Trump administration. His regime is considered one of the most repressive in Egypt's modern history, perhaps the most repressive. There's been tens of thousands of people of critics and activists have been jailed by the Sisi regime. Basic freedoms are deprived. Torture exists in the prisons. And under President Trump, he could do no wrong. But with President Biden coming in, there's been presumably a much bigger focus on human rights. And President Biden made it extremely clear in the very beginning that he would take no more blank checks. And he urged Sisi to improve his pretty much abysmal human rights record. So for the first 4 months of his presidency, Biden didn't even phone Sisi, which is an unprecedented snub of a key Mideast ally. So when the Israeli-Palestinian conflict began again, Sisi sensed an opportunity to get back into the good graces of the American administration. And that's precisely what he's done.
Egypt is one of the only countries in the region that has relationships with both Israel and Hamas. And it has actually helped mediate ceasefires in the last three wars between the two. Sisi also has an alliance with Israel. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Under Sisi, the ties between Egypt and Israel, you know, they signed a peace treaty in 1979. But under Sisi, the relationship between Israel and Egypt has deepened considerably. They have significant political, economic, and particularly security relationships in the region. They both have a shared interest in preventing the Islamic State, which has a branch in Egypt that's operating along the Gaza border in Egypt's northern Sinai. They have a shared desire to prevent the Islamic State from extending its reach. So they've had heavy cooperation along in the northern Sinai and elsewhere.
What about the Egyptian people? Do they support Sisi's close relationship with Israel?
No. I mean, the vast majority of Egyptians are extremely anti-Israel. You know, on social media, in conversations, you know, on dinner tables, they will always attack Israel and defend the Palestinian cause. Even, you know, mundane things like a television show recently, for instance, which depicted Israel in a negative light, was highly applauded by most Egyptians. And another example, there was a picture was taken, an Egyptian and Israeli singer, popular singers in Dubai, and the picture was just two of them standing together, and it went absolutely viral in the Arab world. And Egyptians were extremely furious at the Egyptian singer's agreement to take a photograph alongside the Israeli, to the point where like an investigation was started, and the local theatrical union sought to ban him from ever playing or acting or singing. So it caused a huge uproar, and this was just a single picture.
Mm. We know that Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which Sisi banned in Egypt when he took power back in 2013. What is Sisi's relationship with Hamas?
It's a very pragmatic relationship. Sisi's regime banned the Muslim Brotherhood, outlawed it, and he put thousands of Muslim Brotherhood members in jail. So he's no fan of the Muslim Brotherhood, and one would think he's no fan of Hamas either. But he and Egypt, they cozy up to Hamas largely for pragmatic reasons, because it helps Egypt play a vital role in the region, as we just saw last week, as a key mediator, as a negotiator. Egypt is able to put pressure on Hamas because Egypt controls the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. It's the only other way to kind of bring in goods and to help Hamas and to help Palestinians in that area. Of course, having said all this, the Egyptians have also played this delicate balance because, in fact, the Gaza Strip is actually closed, and Egypt has joined Israel in an economic blockade of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Right, which is why I'm asking you these questions, because it seems like it would be hard for Sisi to be a champion of the Palestinians while also maintaining a good relationship with Israel.
Yes, you know, he does have to play this delicate balance, but you know what? He's also has a very good internal propaganda machine. Everything he does for Palestine is trumpeted in Egypt. For instance, his announcement of a $500 million rebuilding reconstruction plan for Gaza was widely publicized in the state-run media here. This was all to give the impression that he is a close supporter of the Palestinians, and in that sense, gain score points with the vast majority of Egyptians who are very anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian.
Putting all of this in context, this ceasefire, as you've laid out, has been a very important step in the relationship between Sisi and President Biden. What does this all mean for Sisi's reputation and relationship moving forward with the U.S.?
It means a lot. I mean, Sisi at the beginning of this year was essentially in a diplomatic quicksand. You know, his champion, President Trump, had gone, and President Biden had, even during the campaign, presidential campaign, had clearly indicated that he did not appreciate Sisi's the human rights abuses, the deprivation of freedoms happening in Egypt. So with his role, his significant role in reaching a ceasefire between the Israeli Palestinians, what Sisi has shown is that he's incredibly important to America, especially in this region. At one point, there were politicians and lawmakers in the U.S. who were questioning Sisi's and Egypt's role in the Middle East. I mean, Egypt has had a very storied role in the history of the Middle East. But in recent years, you know, Egypt has kind of taken a backside to some extent to countries like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Turkey. And so by playing this key role in achieving the ceasefire, Sisi and Egypt has indicated that it's an important player and should be recognized, even as it continues to repress its people.
Well, with that, what does this all mean for Sisi regionally and domestically?
Well, regionally, you know, Sisi has shown that he's once again a player. I mean, for years now, he has been overshadowed on other crises in the region, such as the Syrian conflict, by Saudi Arabia or by Turkey. Even Russia has played a more significant role in the Middle East than Egypt in recent years. But now, with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict halted again, thanks largely to Sisi's effort, he presents himself as, once again, an important player in the region. Now, domestically, too, this is helping Sisi in some ways, some important ways, actually. He's been widely criticized by ordinary Egyptians across the country for spending billions on large infrastructure projects that have really, had not shown any huge positive results yet to boost the economy. In fact, poverty is rampant. Sisi's been trying to create a new image of Egypt, and that has entailed demolishing entire neighborhoods to put roads and highways, and that has also caused criticism. By presenting himself as a champion of the Palestinian cause, he is actually trying to score points with all these Egyptians who are critical of all his other endeavors. But the problem now is the big concern among human rights activists is that because of Sisi's success in bringing the ceasefire, they're concerned that countries like the United States, countries in Western Europe, will look the other way when it comes to Sisi's human rights abuses, because they will see him as an essential diplomatic force to keep calm in the region.
So much more to follow here. Sudarshan Raghavan is the Washington Post's Cairo bureau chief. Thank you so much for this.
My pleasure.
As lawmakers squabble over the size of President Biden's infrastructure plan, there's bipartisan agreement on at least one of its goals, reviving manufacturing. The administration wants to reverse a long-term decline in manufacturing jobs, and it's promising billions of dollars for workforce training programs to help do that. Hundreds of thousands of jobs are going unfilled, even as manufacturers are reporting a post-pandemic surge in demand for products. Employers say while there are plenty of people looking for work, few have the skills needed to land a job in today's manufacturing industry. Here now is Chris Bentley, reports on efforts to close that gap.
Adonis Somerville is punching coordinates into a computerized milling machine, giving instructions to a robotic arm that will cut a block of plastic or metal into a precise shape, anything from electrical outlets to screws used in surgery. Somerville is a teacher at the Jane Addams Resource Corporation, a Chicago nonprofit that trains people in skills needed to land manufacturing jobs, especially people traditionally underrepresented in the industry. 10 years ago, Somerville was a student here, a young father unemployed and recently released from prison.
Almost my kid came into the world, I figured I had to do something. And I actually saw someone on a bus one day, and they asked me what I was doing with my life, and I had no straight answer, and he actually told me about this place. It was someone I went to high school with, and the rest is kind of history from there.
Somerville was recruited for a job before he finished the 20-week training program. He started at $10 an hour, but one job led to the next, and within 6 years, he says he was earning nearly six figures, making mechanical seals and other industrial components.
You know, I always tell people, you can have a job and you can have a career. I'm like, a job, you can live paycheck to paycheck. A career, you can build a future on.
Nick Giraj hopes to build a career like that. He recently signed up for Somerville's training program. He's had jobs in construction, retail, and vehicle inspections, but
I just felt like I wasn't moving up. I was just stagnant.
Giraj says some of the manufacturing jobs he's aiming for offer starting pay double what he was earning before, with more opportunity for benefits. And he says it's difficult to automate or outsource the CNC skills he's learning today.
It's a position that's not going to get cut out. You still need somebody to load the parts and do all that. So I figure it's future-proof.
Welding is another skill manufacturers say is in short supply among the labor force. That's what Alexis Ramirez is practicing down the hall. She started learning the trade after she lost her job as a waitress.
I needed something that was more solid, something more dependable, and especially with the pandemic, and this just seemed like an exciting, fun thing that when they gave me the chance, I took it.
Ramirez says she wants to open her own shop someday. But first, she's just happy to be mastering the basics.
I had a friend that their dad was a welder, and, I would go over and just see the sparks flying in the garage and just think, like, man, that really seems awesome, but I didn't think it was something I was maybe capable of doing. It seemed maybe, you know, hard or, you know, a man's job, a lot of people say, or, you know, but it's something I'm capable of, and it's really empowering. The whole thing has been really great.
Ramirez is 36, young compared to the average American working in manufacturing. And that's a problem for the industry.
Every 8 seconds, a baby boomer retires.
That's Carolyn Lee. She's in charge of workforce development for the National Association of Manufacturers. And she says as those baby boomers retire, it leaves a hole in the labor market. Advanced manufacturing jobs require new skills rarely taught in school. Employers hope the government will spend more on job training programs to help close that gap.
You have this constant movement as you're bringing on new facilities, new skills, new equipment, in addition to just a dynamic, you know, economy that is growing. I mean, manufacturing right now, the demand is there, but we can't keep up. We don't have the workers.
And there's another problem. Some would-be employees have an outdated perception of what these jobs are really like.
Well, you know, many people still think it's like dark, dirty, dingy.
That's Diana Peters. She's executive director of Symbol Training Institute, another Chicago area program that trains people in advanced manufacturing and helps find them jobs. Dark and dingy does not describe the mood here. It can get loud, but a lot of manufacturing these days looks as much like scientific lab work as it does a traditional factory floor, with students taking precise measurements and calculating coordinates to program machines.
All right, so now the center line is right on that edge right there, and we located our wire.
Symbol has been open throughout the pandemic, as have most of the manufacturers that recruit its trainees.
So in the beginning, you know, we didn't have as many individuals coming to us, but now that things are opening up and people are more comfortable and they're not wanting to go into the service industry anymore, this is a great, great option.
Some training centers like Symbol are starting to build up wait lists as more people sign up to learn the skills that employers say are in short supply. Peters hopes it's a sign of renewed interest in an industry that she says is overlooked. But jobs are still going unfilled, which could mean the industry is changing faster than job training programs can keep up with. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.